If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. I am so happy to be able to introduce you to Rebecca Limov. She is fascinating. She is so smart. It was so nice to talk to her. And she also just seems like a genuinely nice person. I hope one day to meet her in person. She's a historian of science at Harvard University and has been a visiting scholar at the Max Planck Institute. Her research explores data, technology, and the history of human and behavioral sciences. She lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts with her family. And her book, The Instability of Truth, Brainwashing, Mind Control, and Hyper-Persuasion, is available through Norton. You can go on to her website, to her Instagram page, and buy her book. We'll put all the links to all of this in the show notes. Here's Rebecca now. I'm delighted to have Rebecca Limov with me today, who is going to be speaking about a lot of subjects that are near and dear to my heart and to my clients and to colleagues. And being able to show, I think, how malleable something is that seems like it should be stationary and solid. Something as important as truth, it's something you want to be able to rely on and lean on and know that you can't just sort of push it over when you're leaning on it, but it seems all too easy to do that. And so I would love to be able to just get into our conversation, but first to have you spend a moment introducing yourself. Go ahead.
Thanks so much for having me, Rachel. It's great to meet you. I love the way you started with the idea that this is a topic close to our hearts, because I do find this to be one myself. I've been working on this for 25 years or so, the topic of brainwashing, which came to me when I was writing my dissertation as a grad student at UC Berkeley in anthropology. Ultimately, I ended up in the field of history of science, and this set of questions followed me, which were basically at first kind of theoretical questions. You know, how much are we controlled by our circumstances? What really is the self? How much, and can it be changed under various or even obliterated under certain conditions? So this led me to study the history of the social sciences, of psychology, of the behavioral sciences, and of experiments with rodents as part of, you know, behaviorism. This was part of my doctoral training and or my chosen research topic. And then I ended up having some personal experiences in this domain that, in a sense, gave me insight at a different level. And I can go into that more later. But just to finish up the self-introduction, I ended up leaving the field of anthropology because I, you know, had ended up writing a more historical approach. And it seemed that that was recognizable to the field of history of science, which is a very small but kind of wonderful set of scholars that started at Harvard, you know, back in the early 20th century, developing a new field, which was to study how science works and how we know truth and how do we gain knowledge. And I ended up being hired there first as a postdoc, then as a professor, and that's where I spent the last couple, like a decade or so. And the idea of brainwashing and the set of questions that I was asking came with me because they are close to my heart. I started teaching a class there many years ago, and then I've finally written this book in the last several years.
And I'm so glad you did, and it's wonderful. And at the end, we'll talk about where people can find it and find you. There is something so interesting about truth, too, as we're talking, and also identity. I've mentioned on this podcast that being a therapist in this field, you get asked unique and quite existential questions that other therapists might not get asked, like, who am I? I don't know who I am. I don't know what I think. What are my thoughts? I don't know what I'm supposed to like and not like. People who were born and raised in groups really have an identity that has been given to them. They've needed to be this empty vessel. And people who got involved in something later on, whether it was a cult or a relationship with someone who was highly controlling and controlled them and their self-concept, they also have confusion about if it's possible to go back to who they were, finding a lot of the time that they can, but with now this added pressure of having self-doubt, because if they come to their own conclusions, they were told they would be the wrong ones. So they're in this sort of state of limbo. And so it's a very interesting thing to not have an identity that feels sure in this world. I'm sure that's disorienting, to say the least. And that's probably something you've come across in your studies.
Well, the research experience itself has been profound. Also, personal experiences I've had along the way. But one moment that stands out is going to a meeting of ICSA, or the International Cultic Studies Association, which I think you're on the board of. So in Santa Fe, and meeting members of the second generation members of the, I guess it was the Tony Alamo Christian Ministries group. And it's just profound because I hadn't really thought of it on that level. What would it mean to be, not to have chosen to be in a group like that? And how would you assemble or construct or find out who you are afterwards? And just watching, hearing them so profoundly and like courageously wrestle with those questions, not having answered them on a panel I attended, was really influential for me. So, and I think guiding my research is this insight that became clearer over time, is just that we consistently underestimate how malleable we are as human beings. I mean, on one level, that's probably the definition of being adaptable and having a survival instinct, but it also can be used, it can be weaponized or used against people in various ways, or can lead to certain situations that are difficult to extract yourself from.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think about a lot of these controllers, manipulators, cult leaders, you know, because you see them in these one-on-one, these sort of dyads of control in relationships, and then also on a larger scale within a cult. There's so much about it that is just so manipulative. They'll often offer people testimonials or have people come up and say, you know, well, I didn't know who I was and my life was going nowhere. And other leaders will say, left to your own devices, was everything perfect in your life? No, it wasn't perfect. And was your life going in the exact direction that you wanted it to go in? No, it wasn't, whatever that means, because that can change too. But that there was this sense that you were going to be going down a bad path. It's part of the reason also that I have some trouble with 12-step programs, because of this absolute identity that you are this. You are now an alcoholic, let's say, and that you have to call yourself that, even though for most people that's actually not the issue, that they were self-medicating because they have another issue. But that if you leave, you will wind up dead in the gutter. It's also absolute. That will be your identity. You will be a failure. You will die. And there's no space in between. And so while I don't want people to leave their 12-step group as we're hearing about this, if it has been helpful to you, but know that you're going to have to take on certain monikers and threats that are absolute. And you can, I think, take them on if you feel like it's going to, you can take them on in kind of name only, I think, you know, if it's going to help you feel like you're being accepted in that group. But I think internally to know you might be different from that, and that's okay. And so I think it's like giving people permission to have their own sense of things that I think feels a little more sophisticated than just this sort of black and white thing. And something else I was going to say, and then I want to hand this back to you, is that sometimes when people say, who am I? I don't know how to define me. One of the things that I'll sometimes say is sometimes it's hard to know who you are by starting with a list of who you are and what you are. It might be easier to start with who you're not. Like if there is someone who's done something around you that really actually bothers you, then that's not who you are. Or you've been told to lie to people to recruit them into something, and it's always felt wrong because that's not who you are. Like sitting at a lunch table at school when you're young and you have a lot of, you know, girls or whoever gossiping or being mean girls, and you're thinking, oh, I feel like I have to take a shower and get this off me. That is not who I am. And that sometimes is a way that we start.
That's amazing. That's a great technique. I mean, it reminds me of the story that I found inspiring at the beginning of my research, which was from Czesław Miłosz, the Polish poet who won the Nobel Prize, and he's famous for writing a book called The Captive Mind, which I happened to find while walking down the street one day in a state of confusion myself in the East Bay. And it was this lovely red book someone had discarded, and I started to read it, and I think it did set me on this path of, you know, specifically the question of brainwashing. And he really, so what the story he tells is how he found himself after World War II in communist Poland. The government had been taken over. The troops from, you know, the East had subdued his country. And if he wanted, and the most important thing in his life was to be an artist and to create poetry. But in order to do that, he would have to actually change himself internally, create a kind of subjective self-brainwashing in a way to truly, to become a true believer of the system, which he called the new faith. And if he couldn't do that, he would never be able to write in his native tongue, Polish. And then, you know, his life, he would have to leave. So he said about, he tells a story about, you know, the analogy he gives is that say you're someone tells you you have to eat live frogs to be healthy. And of course, you want to be healthy. So you go, you eat the first live frog. It's not a particularly good experience. But then you think, well, they gave me, you know, it's probably good advice. I should just try to get used to it. You eat the second frog. And then he tells a story and he says that after he ate the second frog, in other words, tried to stay, tried to adopt the system and tried to change himself, he suffered, he couldn't eat the third one. He was between the second and the third frog. And at that point, he had what he called a revolt of the stomach. And he's very clear that it wasn't that he somehow had an elevated philosophical reaction to what he was being made to believe. It was really just that in his guts, he couldn't do that. He couldn't eat another one. And that's what made him seek exile. And he ultimately ended up in California in the Berkeley Hills and taught at UC Berkeley and ended up winning the Nobel Prize and all these things that he couldn't have expected. But really, it was just a visceral kind of reaction that reminded me of what you were saying. It's almost like, what am I not? I'm not going to be doing that. Or this is not, this was something that was a bridge too far. It's not me. And it's very clarifying because very few people know. I mean, there's a reason the great philosophers say to know yourself is the ultimate aim. It's not that you can just look it up on Wikipedia or it's given to you when you're born in your birth certificate or that it's an easy thing. It's a hard thing to know yourself.
Oh, very hard thing. And it also is not etched in stone. I mean, the self, I think you know, you have a sense of yourself, but things also can change over time. And to be able to be open to that, that sometimes it's hard for people who like things to be known and stay the same. You know, I it's a very interesting story about the frogs and a revolt of the stomach. I like the way that was said. I think that it is interesting also that you were mentioning Berkeley, because I'm remembering a study that maybe we'll get into that was from 2020 with a professor from Berkeley and a professor from Yale, where they asked or they paid participants to switch from one news network that had one particular leaning to another news network that had a different one for a month to see if that would change them, to see about the influence of media. And there were a lot of changes. And then they noticed after the people were not paid anymore and the month was over, a lot of people reverted back, but that they were able to be transformed in their ideas during that time, which says a lot about influence.
That's so fascinating. I have a little anecdote that is similar to that that you just reminded me of, which is the professor just came to visit Harvard and gave this distinguished lecture, and we had lunch beforehand, and he's this amazing historian who studied digital economies and the history of knowledge, things like that. Anyway, he said he comes from Reno. His parents recently sold their house, so he had to go back. And he was working on the house with a guy who lives in Reno, who's his carpenter. And he said he's one of the smartest people he's ever met, this guy. So they spent a week or two in a kind of a news bubble, because the guy from Reno listens only to like Fox News or various sources that he himself was not usually familiar with. And because of that, he experienced a recent big news event through that lens. And he was saying, because, you know, he had switched silos, he perceived it differently, and he still feels differently about it a bit, even though when he went back to, he lives in New York, you know, that changed again. But I think it gets to a point you were also making, which is about the assumption of permanence. We think that profound changes are somehow permanent, or that an identity is permanent, but actually they're not perpetual. And that even Chairman Mao, you know, who authored this incredibly effective way of thought reforming people, he himself said, even I need to have my thought reform, my re-education renewed. It never lasts for anybody. Like, he was well aware. That's why they kept shipping people out to the countryside. So we all, and every identity likewise, is both a powerful tool, but also can work against you because it's limiting.
What I think is interesting as we're talking about identity and why things need to get repeated, and there need to be new neural networks, there needs to be this reminder of the message, and also why so often there needs to be an infusion of fear in the message to try to embed it, you know, that we have to really work hard on these things if we're going to try to influence people. The people sometimes who come to see me who have recently left or escaped from a certain relationship or a cultic group feel like they have been through a war, especially during the last month or two that they were there. And it often felt like there was this panic, because there was a sense that the person might leave, the person might not have been totally convinced. And so we need to work harder to make sure that we can convince them of something and to get them to stay. And it's, for some people, it's effective, and other people, just how insistent and how hard they're coming at them maintains their resolve that this is not a safe place and I really need to go. But that they've been through so much that is to influence them, like this last ditch effort, and they're so glad to be free of that. But even though they're free, there's this sense that people in my field talk about where you are physically out, but emotionally or spiritually in. And so people will sometimes say, oh, I'm so glad to be free of that, but then realize they have the thinking, like they're done with the cult, but the cult isn't done with them. And so they still have to work on getting it out of their system like a poison, you know?
You know, you mentioned people feeling like they've been in a war. And then in conditions I studied, where people actually were in a war, prisoners of war, who experienced these kind of re-education campaigns at the end of a long period of imprisonment themselves. Well, one thing they would, I mean, they have recognizable similarities with what you're describing, which is why the experts went from the Cold War POWs to cults seamlessly, because they saw the same patterns. But often on the other side of it, I noticed, like, if you look at Robert J. Lifton's first article, which is called Home by Ship, where he studied, he traveled with several, I think it was several dozen POWs, who prisoners who'd been injured and they had been subjected to, you know, indoctrination and mind control. And several of them wrote a poem together. And in the poem, they said, yes, I was injured. Yes, I was tortured. Yes, I went through things, but you'll never understand. So why, I'm paraphrasing it. It wasn't a beautiful poem, but what I got from it was Lifton wrote it he copied it down into the paper. And I thought it was such a beautiful expression of just that sense of futility. Like, I'm out, but this thing is still in me. And the way that it got there, or the things I've been through, are just so difficult that I despair of anyone understanding, which is kind of similar to what I've heard people say, you know, have being on the other side of it too. It's a short article that he wrote. I think it was in 1956. It's very early, but from one of the first descriptions of what would later be called brainwashing or thought reform. And the soldiers were right that people didn't understand what had happened persistently. And that even though brainwashing became known, it was kind of turned into this freakish or shameful thing that had happened to them, even though, you know, what they had been through was engaged in service, captured by a hostile government, starved half to death. Many, many, many died, more than in World War II, a far greater percentage of the POWs, simply of starvation and despair and physical debility, weakness. But part of the, you know, in the end, what would emerge in the public eye was just that something terrible had happened, and that there was something wrong with these men, that they had succumbed to it, not a more complex story.
I wonder if when people do that, and it happens so often, I think of people who have been attacked, violated, and, you know, throughout the history of our legal system, and also the way people respond to it socially, there is the blaming of the victim. Well, why did you go to that party? And why were you wearing that? And why did you trust this person when you should have known? And focuses usually on the wrong person. And it remains there because I think it's easier. It's like low-hanging fruit socially. And then we don't have to think about these people out there who might be doing these, who might be predators, who are doing these things on purpose, and because that's a little less fun to think about. But it's like the age-old question, why did you stay? Okay, fine, it's valid. There are like 50 reasons, but you might not understand unless you're really open to seeing the influence, the danger that someone feels about leaving, etc., and really getting, like, zooming out, seeing the big picture of it all. I was one time asked to speak about that, to talk about why people stay in difficult or abusive situations at a National Association of Social Workers conference. And I did this whole talk. And then I thought, I'm going to have to end with this line, that because I think this is probably the most important part, and I might not get asked to come back. But here I go. And I'm conflict averse, so it was not easy. But I thought, you know, so after a 45-minute talk on why people stay, I just ended by saying, but that's not the right question. Let's not be asking the person why they stayed. Let's try to learn about what happens in certain situations that causes people to stay in bad situations. Let's learn about that socially. Let's learn about that psychologically. And let's see if we can focus on the perpetrator, not the victim, and have them feel questioned. Then the room got a little quieter.
Yeah.
But I thought I at least needed to throw that in.
Did you get asked back, and was there a response to that? Or I suppose because people might feel defensive that they had indeed asked that question, but.
Yeah. So I felt like I wanted to say it nicely, which I tried to do. really good question. I'm really glad we've had a chance to talk about this. And I'm glad that I got to honor so many of my clients who have told me all the reasons that they stayed. And now I got to say those things out loud to the public. And I'm very happy I got to do that. And I also want to say that they have said that that question is really hard and they wish they would stop getting asked that question.
You probably get asked. I mean, it reminds me of the question that was always asked of Patricia Hearst, and also, I think former cult members, things like, why didn't you just walk away? Wasn't the door open? And with her, I mean, there appeared to be, if you looked at it externally without considering the social, psychological and violent dynamics, that she was abducted. It appeared she had ample opportunities to walk away. You could trace them on a map. But it's interesting too that it was so difficult to explain how difficult it was to explain even this extreme case in a way that made a jury or the public or even experts sympathetic to finding out what you just said, which is like, what might that be like, or what might have contributed to this?
Right. I think about the women who were part of Manson's family who, spent lifetimes in jail. And so are they perpetrators? Are they victims? How do we manage that in our own heads? I'm wondering, just to hear about your experiences also that drew you into this domain, as much as you're comfortable sharing them, I'd love you to be able to talk more about that now.
Yeah, I'll just explain as much as I can, but because I've been rethinking it, and I find it really interesting to think back over this territory, which is now 25 years ago. But I think initially I had the set of questions that were mostly theoretical, but as they say, be careful what you ask to understand, because you may get more than, I feel that I was given a deeper knowledge, more, experiential knowledge of that question. On one level, just what happened in graduate school was this kind of fashion for French theory and, these kind of spectacular theorists like Derrida and Lyotard. It was the height of postmodernism when I went to graduate school and met many people in my program were swept up in these texts and things, they're almost like scriptures where they seem to offer some answer. They were so difficult to interpret. People, Jacques Lacan, this kind of legendary French psychoanalyst who used to end his sessions after 3 minutes. I mean, maybe there was something to it, but he, he wrote these really inscrutable texts, and people would, my friends would walk around waving the books or trying to find some deeper meaning in it. And we all kind of adopted a way of writing that reflected that, kind of vying to seem more and more inscrutable and wise and so smart. And I got to the point where I was being praised by my, professors and, this might be even better than my work. And it seemed that if you were at the very edge of being understood, that was all the better. And that I showed this to a friend of mine outside of my program who was a longtime journalist. And he read my paper and he said, this doesn't even sound like you. Like, this doesn't even necessarily sound like English. And I realized I had just a moment of shock that something of which I was so proud, maybe I had moved away. I said no lives were ruined, but just only prose. And I do think that it was not a useful way. I mean, I'm not saying these thinkers are useless at all. I learned a lot from them, but just what I had, the process I had been through was something I had to readjust from. So that's an interesting experience. But on a more profound level, or a little bit around that time or a little bit later, I ended up entering a controlling relationship and a drug addiction that were kind of combined, which had to do with, I guess, a sense at root that I had disappointed my family, or basically things in my life became such that I didn't really want to feel them. I discovered this solution, which was entirely successful at first. And I entered into this relationship that provided drugs and a kind of a way out. And this lasted for some time, to the point where I lost touch with most of my friends and a lot of my family. And at some point I realized that I just Yeah, I didn't know if I would ever get out, and that it was very dark. Wherever I was, it was very dark in there. And then I was fortunate to get the chance to, like you're saying, sometimes there's just an opening to leave, and people, maybe the person you're with or the situation you're in, will redouble its efforts to retain you. But I just, for whatever reasons I kind of attribute to good fortune, I was able to remove myself. And yeah, it's just changed my life to have had that experience too. So in a weird way, it's a good fortune. And I learned, you know, a year or two later, so it was easy to stop the addiction once I was out of that relationship, and also began meditating several hours a day. And I've kept up that practice, and that kind of formed the root of inquiry that I've followed ever since.
That's really powerful, really, really powerful. And the fact that you were able to pull yourself out of that, when it sounds like, you know, there are two things happening simultaneously, which makes it harder. I think it is really amazing that you got to a point where you said no more. And if you haven't been in those situations before, it's very hard to know how you can take those steps and what those steps are physically, emotionally, to get yourself out. And I just don't know if you had support during that time or what was helpful to you, because that's a question that comes up a lot for listeners of the podcast and people who come to me for therapy who are still stuck in a situation or have loved ones. And I'm wondering what helped you. It sounds like just getting to being done with it was a really good first step. But then what?
It was a bit of like getting my body out the door. And I found a place to live that was not far from there. Strangely enough, that was like half a mile away. But I, at any rate, there was a period of, I guess, vacillation. There was also just, I got back in touch with some of my friends, which was really an extraordinary thing. I mean, actually, one of the few friends that I had remained in touch with had helped me so much in those last weeks, where she had just said something to me that was so clarifying. That it was just like a little something to hang on to. And then one funny thing that happened, I don't know if this is helpful to other people, but I was walking down the hallway of my, where I was going to school, and I just brushed it. I was wearing a backpack, and people would hang these pamphlets using masking tape, and somehow this pamphlet had gotten all torn up, and the masking tape stuck to my backpack. And when I came out, there was like a, these words on the pamphlet had all been rearranged, and it said, "You get the chance, one's life." It was very strange. I guess it had been originally some group that was meeting, but it felt like just there was this sense of momentousness that I did get this chance. And I felt so, even as it was hard and very disorienting, and something that it took me years to, I certainly didn't talk to my parents about it initially, or really not that many people at all. But there was just some sense of momentous, like, you do get the chance now to not have this keep happening.
Right. That this doesn't have to be your life.
Yeah.
You don't have to be resigned to it. Well, that is interesting. Oh, my goodness. How fortuitous that all...
And the meditation later, which I did about a year later, was incredibly helpful. But it might be hard to do an intensive meditation retreat right away if you've just left a difficult situation. Even so, it was incredibly intense because I was sitting with the entire experience at, you know, when I went to meditate, it sort of, I processed a lot of it.
Mm. It's wonderful. I'm glad you found a practice that is really, really helpful to you. And whatever words you ascribe to why it's helpful, for some people it's centering or whatever other words they use, but it's important that it's personal for you and you do it the way that works for you. And it's really good to have these tools. And just, it's also true that there are people who have been in cultic groups where they did a lot of meditation, where it's hard, very hard to go back into a meditative practice and because I found that a lot of cult groups really don't know the first thing about, really about the mind, about science, that they don't know that there's a certain percentage of the population that find meditation actually anxiety producing and like it's an irritant in the system. And so then they're told by their leader to just do it more. And like you're having trouble sleeping, have more caffeine, you know, like that. That's what it's like for some people in their bodies. So for people to see what works for them and to be able to stay with it, whatever it is, and to know there are choices out there that work within your physiology, that it's really smart that you're using what works for you.
That's such a good point. I mean, initially, it was such a profound experience that I thought everybody should do this, but I have discovered it's not indicated for everyone. It doesn't affect everyone the same way. It's, you know, that you, and it's an ongoing process of figuring out and listening to your own responses to things. So that, and I think one thing, it's a profoundly difficult thing that a lot of cults do abuse meditation or use meditation, that, and it can be a destabilizing force, as well as this happens with psychedelics as well.
Right, exactly. Yes. I think also when a group has this idea that this one thing is the answer, this one thing is the thing you need, then they also build into their system that if it doesn't work, that's because of you. You're not doing it right, or you're not doing it enough, because they don't have other things to offer you. So they'll just make it your fault if it doesn't work. So I'm wondering then, to go back to actually this point that you brought up about inscrutable texts, because people are often under this assumption that if something is not easily understood, that it's of a higher level. And there are many cult groups that will offer courses at great expense so that you can understand these texts, which are to a great degree word salad and doesn't really have one meaning. And so they're just kind of keeping you busy, and they're keeping you feeding the coffers of the group. And so I even think about, there are times that you've probably seen this too. You've been in a museum and you read this description of an art piece and you're like, okay, stop it. I don't know what any, what? I don't get, stop. It just, it's like, stop. It's like, they're working so hard to sound esoteric and I don't know, but it just feels like they're being posers. I don't know. I don't buy into it. And so what is that about us that makes us think that what's not understandable is above us rather than maybe that it just doesn't make sense?
Well, I think there's two parts of that that are both extremely important and interesting. I mean, it does remind me of firsthand testimonies of even Steve Hassan, and he's visited my class and talked about, and in his book, he writes about how, and others as well, who've been, you know, brought into cults. At first, they're exposed to some text, you know, some, or also very boring lectures. And at first, they make no sense. And then at a certain point, there's like a click where they start to make a whole lot of sense. And suddenly the person is, you know, feeling that they're in the presence of a profound truth. And so inscrutability, something at the very edge of comprehensibility, does speak to the limitations of language, I think, and that as human beings, I think there is a realm that's beyond description, and certain truths cannot really adequately be put into words. That's what poetry, like a real poet lives at that edge. You know, I've even thought, yeah, just the attempt to put into words that which resists it and is far more beautiful or more complex or just at the far limit is also what painters do, I think, a lot of times, and just things that we really value. So that gesturing at that realm is really powerful. Unfortunately, in the case of word salad and perhaps some of these excessive French philosophers, some would argue, there's a little bit of bullshit, I guess, or just sort of like maybe manipulating that tendency to attribute extra wisdom to something that actually the person's quite confused. They themselves are confused, or they have a malicious or sort of a deceptive intent and they want to sound smarter. This happens all the time in academia where you could say it a lot more simply, but then you would be revealing that what you're saying isn't really that, is pretty basic. And you don't get tenure for that. You don't get promotion. So there's a kind of ritualized way of putting things that makes it more difficult sometimes to understand until you're inculcated into. So you can see these things operating. It's sometimes the consequences seem minor and sometimes they can be much more serious.
Right. I'm remembering a conversation I had with one of my kids where he was talking about the use of sort of flowery language and how distracting it is. And sometimes it also paints a picture. And he said, like, and he started describing this thing of food and just the way he described it. And I said, and what is it that you just, I mean, it was paragraphs of stuff. And I said, what did you just describe? And he said, a hamburger. I just described, like, the bun was this brioche of something from the whatever, something of France. There's a lot of connected to France. And so, yeah, I think, and you can read like L. Ron Hubbard's texts, which make no sense. And it's difficult because I feel like it really is to make people feel less than, and to make people feel they have to strive and that they might not ever really get there. And then you have people pretending to get it, which I think also makes people split off from the self, which is really also disorienting because a lot of people are faking it in cults. They're pretending that they are getting it. They're pretending that this is the best life ever and they're suffering inside. And people will also, yeah, they'll talk about feeling like they're two different people when they leave something like this because they've had to split off the self. I'm remembering now one time going to a pre-introductory meeting of this group called the Kabbalah Learning Center that I'd been studying for many years. And I said on the podcast that if I have a chance to go to an open meeting of a group that I might not know a lot about, I will do that just so I can say this was my experience within it. And the instructor said, let me tell you about what truth is. And truth is all the things that you can't take in through your senses. So everything you see, everything that you hear, everything you touch, whatever, is not the truth because our senses confuse us. They will take in wrong information at times. They'll think a sound of something is something else. And so the only truth that is real truth are the things that are invisible, that are things you can't smell, can't see, can't touch. And we are the ones who can show you what that is.
Oh, dear. That's really setting you up for an unfortunate situation very quickly, isn't it? Just to teach you to deny all the evidence of your own senses. I mean, that's the anti-Buddha, I guess. Or you could say that's highly, it would seem highly manipulative.
Right. Highly manipulative, dependency producing. Well, if you're my only guide to truth, and I can't see it myself, but you can, then I need you, you know?
Right. I mean, but seems amazing to put it on the table right away, but I suppose it's a kind of calling card to those who desire a mystery that only can be accessed through a special relationship, I think people are often powered by both their best impulses and their worst, I think, in these relationships.
Interesting. So talk about that if you can. It's very intriguing.
I mean, one example is, I think with the people that Robert J. Lifton studied before before the 70s, but in the 50s and 60s, who were citizens of either of Western countries who had left China, but they had been re-educated, or they were Chinese citizens who were highly educated people who had also been re-educated, that he writes about in Thought Reform and the Psychology of Totalism. So he talks about how each person, for the Thought Reform, would both appeal to their generosity, like their sense of justice. This also was true with the POWs, some sense that there could be a more just society, and perhaps communism offered that. Perhaps it would draw attention to the inequalities in their own lives that they had just sort of brushed aside, like we all do. And so that kind of larger vision and idealism that many people, or most people probably have some elements of those qualities, or can be used against you. They can be leveraged against you in a sense to adopt the system. But at the same time, also maybe their more negative impulses could also be turned against them. A sense of guilt or childhood experiences that had led to certain responses or reactions, or a sense that they were in the wrong, like, you know, maybe even their trauma could also be leveraged to tie them in to a kind of system that would then be highly controlling. And to go back to a comment you were making a little while ago, it reminds me of one of the people Lifton talked with was this guy called Dr. Vincent, and he was a French physician who had been treating people in China for some time, and he hadn't wanted to leave. He loved being in China. He'd been educated in France, and he had many patients, and he just thought he would never be arrested by the regime because he was doing such good work as a physician. But he was arrested one day, and as he went through this procedure, he was put in shackles. He was interrogated all night. He was started to bleed from his arms and wrists and his ankles. He had to, you know, he couldn't even use his hands to unzip his fly to like pee. He, you know, the other prisoners in his cell had to do it for him. So he was reduced to total dependency. He had to eat off the floor like a dog, all these things. And he had to undergo long struggle sessions with his cellmates. And they already knew his guilt. So initially he would say, "I'm not a spy," because they were accusing him of being a spy for the West. And he just knew he wasn't. But after a while, after a certain amount of time, he agreed. And he had to come to believe that he was a spy. And the way they did it was taking certain little details from his previous life, like, I do remember one day I had a conversation on the street corner where I told this guy the price of shoes in China, and he was French, and maybe he told someone. And so that the interrogators would turn that around to say, "You were giving information." And, you know, in order to get the chains removed, and he was highly motivated to like stop his own pain, he sort of ended up crafting this complicated story, really a kind of word salad, saying in what way he had been a spy for Western imperialism and that he was guilty to his core and that he deserved to potentially be executed. But instead, they showed him mercy and released him to Hong Kong. And he said, "One thing I find haunting and interesting and related to what you're describing is," he said, "it's a special kind of truth." And when he came out, he was between those two truths. So he said, he thought Robert J. Lifton might actually be a spy. So he said, "I don't know how to, I can see you from two standpoints. Either you're a doctor who means to help me and wants to talk to me, or you've been sent by them." And he said, he was between two truths. And he didn't know which standpoint. From the people's standpoint, something heroic and wonderful has happened to me. I've been changed. I've been made to see the error of my ways. I understand the nature of, you know, the proper system and the true way of life. But from another point of view, something terrible has happened to me. I've been tortured. I've been destroyed. I've been treated terribly, unjustly. So he could simultaneously have these operating in him while he, you know, and Lifton met him only days after he had been released. I thought that was profound, just this idea of a special kind of truth, and that, you know, it's hard to, maybe that stays with you too. You can always access that, which can be disquieting.
Mm-hmm. Special kind of truth. So here, looking at that situation, and I would look at it in terms of the psychology and the social psychology of it, because that's for me where the truth is in the situation. That the truth for me in that story is that you can put people in a situation where they will say or do what they need to survive, or believe what they need to, even temporarily, to make it make sense or to survive. But what he actually said doesn't matter to me as much. matter to them and it matters to him, but just that it shows the power of intimidation and keeping someone feeling like they don't have other choices.
Right. That the truth is not abstract. It was a special kind of truth that allowed him to live to tell the tale. That's what other, you know, countless other people testify. Yes, like Patty Hearst said, yes, I had to become a soldier in their army. That was true. It didn't mean it was permanent. It didn't mean she wanted to do that, but she did decide she wanted to survive this experience, which was her choice. And having chosen that, she had to change herself sufficiently to actually, you know, take the next step. So I think that it's a special kind of truth in that way, that it reflects the situation that the person is in.
Right. Wow. Okay. So I'm wondering also, you know, when we talk about things being malleable, we talk about what we consider to be true, but also memory, which can lead to what we think is true or not true. And this being an adaptation for survival, for socialized behavior, for a lot of it. And I'm just wondering about that. I'm wondering about human beings being able to be changed in this way. I don't want to say with so much ease, but that it's possible. And it's possible, I think, for everyone. And so I'd love to just hear more about that, that is, if it is for survival, if that is a necessary adaptation, because I think it's important. Sometimes people are put down for it. Well, but you said this last year, and you said, you know, and now you're saying this, and that, you know, and they're on the witness stand somehow, and people don't like it, but it's built into all of us.
That is really what I ended up concluding after these many years, is just that it's a potential of every moment. It's a potential of all of us, but we so much tend to want to exile this possibility from ourselves and locate it in others because it's deeply uncomfortable. So it's, you know, even just there's sort of a vogue for podcasts or, you know, narrative-driven television shows that tell the story of getting caught in a cult or getting swept up in a scam or getting, you know, whatever, in some inextricable relationship. But often I think these operate almost like fairy tales, distancing tales or devices where you're listening along. And at a certain point, you think that would never have happened to me. Or at this point, I would have walked out, or I never would have believed there was an FBI guy on the other end of the line, or I wouldn't have fallen for that. Or surely Keith Raniere was not actually very handsome. Things like, you know, they surface, like there are moments where this is not me. Whereas I think it's more profound and useful to see it as something anyone is capable of, that we're all in together, you know, and that it's not. So that makes it less of a polarizing experience.
Right. And for it not to be put down, but just to say this is part of us and there's a reason. But I guess also to know that that is a part of you, and then to be cautious about the fact that it is easily, or more easily than we'd like to think, transformed, and how to protect it.
Right. Because, yeah, like you're not inherently protected by a credential, by being super intelligent, by being successful, by being, you know, one thing or another. That's why one reason I wrote myself into the book at certain times is just to show that nobody's really exempt from these processes, much as, you know, so it's not putting anyone down. So it can become just an invitation for awareness and hopefully insight into like that revolt of the stomach, or what you started out talking about is, you know, almost like a moment, just a moment where something is signaling to you, this is not me, or maybe this feels weird, or, you know, just to tune into that, because I think a lot of the types of social media and digital interactions we have tend to exile us from those very feedback systems and bodily moments, and deceptive relationships can also do that.
So I'm wondering also about that, because, you know, you're talking about, like, with POWs, I mean, here, if you're in a camp, you can't access other information. It is, you know, as we talk about this closed loop, And a couple of people who I've worked with have needed something to be mirrored to them. And often these situations are happenstance, which is very interesting. Like here, I can help craft a whole intervention. And then suddenly, like something happens that was not even planned that really actually made the biggest impact. There was a man I was talking to who was very caught up in QAnon. And he was raised in a pretty liberal household, got him really involved in this and found himself in the middle of Times Square, jumping up and down and chanting for the hanging of Hillary Clinton, and was totally involved in this and felt it. And then because he was in Times Square, he caught his reflection in the side of a building and he didn't recognize himself. And he thought, who is this person? And what is this look on my face? And what startled him is that it took him a minute to recognize himself in that. And he thought, oh, that's me. I had never seen myself do that before. And I've never seen that look and that anger and seething with something. And that's what caught him. And that was
a kind of dissonance of the self, but the one that he couldn't at that moment, for whatever reason, paper over. That's so profound. That's a great, amazing story. Reminds me of something that happened to me, which was, and that maybe this is the idea of mirroring, but there's a moment when I went away for 2 weeks and I left the whole relationship. And during that time, I had taken my boyfriend's book of philosophy with me. And when I came back, he said, did you read that book? And I said, yeah. And it was really profound. And he said, no, I don't actually think you can read it. I didn't think you would understand it. Like and I could tell he genuinely didn't think I was capable of understanding this book because he thought I was like on a different level. At that moment, there's just you can insult someone's for various reasons they may be vulnerable to and sort of to have a distortion of maybe their looks or whatever it is. But at a certain level, like I knew I had read the book and I knew it had made an impact on me. And just that discordance or dissonance was very helpful because it was sort of mirroring back. That's not me, but it's really interesting to hear about that. But you would call that mirroring or
It was that there was, literally it was a reflection. And so he didn't see himself in it. And he thought, I've lost myself. And so, he's the one who had that insight. It's not like anyone was doing that to him and saying, look at yourself.
And that never works, does it?
Right. No, it doesn't.
It probably rarely works.
Very rarely. And it needs to be a situation, I think, where the person is sort of open to seeing to a certain degree. But I think, yeah. And he says, at first, he liked seeing all the reflection of seeing all these people jumping up and down and, waving their fists, and it felt strong and it felt unified and there was an energy to it and it was exciting. And then he remembered thinking, who are all these people? And then he saw his face, but that because it took it like a good minute for him to recognize himself, it's in that space of time where there was the disorientation and the lack of identity with self that got him. And so I think this is a situation he created for himself, which made it all the more powerful. It's like this man who I talked to who was raised in a family of white supremacists. And it wasn't until he brought his 4-year-old to a rally where they put them in Ku Klux Klan hoods and all of it for children's size, and that he was watching the footage of it and showing off the people he had had over to his house. And then when he saw his 4-year-old, that's what did it for him. It felt so wrong suddenly because he remembered being that age, wanting to like his neighbor who was a girl who was Hispanic, and he wasn't allowed to be friends with her. And he suddenly, the memory of that came back. And so it was, he had taken the video and he was showing it, and it's a scene he had created for himself. And then suddenly he had that reflection.
He had lived it uncritically, but mm-hmm. the showing of the video opened mm-hmm. up some moment of space to reflect, which is maybe, it's mysterious to me a bit when I read about people who have left cults or why they did. I mean, there's famous case that led to a lawsuit against a certain form of meditation where they're taught to learn to fly. And this guy was, proceeding. And I think he later saw a video of himself doing it. It really just looked like he was awkwardly ruining his hips as he,
bouncing,
flopped across the floor. But, that you could believe it's flying or what. I don't want to get into the details of it, but ended up, I guess seeing it reflected back in a certain way, although it doesn't always work if forced or if there's not a kind of space from that circumstances allow.
So that's so true. So I would love to hear more about from you, just about truth, about brainwashing, about some of the things that you've come across that are great insights, but also how we know to a greater degree what we can rely on as being truth, knowing also that within science, right, truth can change, or the facts can change based on new information, and we need to be open to that too. But how are we able to be more certain and hold on to a sense, or be able to validate if something is more true than not?
I think understanding a less cartoonish version of what science is helpful. I feel lucky to have been adopted into this field of history of science, because really what it studies is that science is a process, not an end point, that it doesn't inevitably unfold in one way. If you look at the history of science, there are different directions it could have taken. Some of them are like the stories we've been telling. I mean, why did Robert Boyle do the experiments he did with the air pump that founded what we think of as the scientific method? He had to seal up his air pump using cheese. Yeah, I mean, it's not a sterile history. It's like a funny, it's just full of happenstance and struggle, and it's made by humans. So it's something that, and yet for all that, it's more, we can appreciate it more, I think, because it is a human process and it shouldn't be worshipped or deployed or weaponized if possible. So I think that therefore it's up to us to use our faculties to discern and to be discerning and to also understand. So one part of it is that, and almost the opposite of the Kabbalah instructions you receive, one's senses do offer. In the end, I mean, experiential, what you experience yourself rather than what you're told or what tricky texts or even wise texts tell you must be useful. They must be taken into account. And then also that what we think of as small decisions, and this isn't to make people more anxious, it's more to draw lessons from these episodes of what appear to be extreme and unusual happenings, such as what happened to POWs or kidnapping victims or people who have been in cults, is that it shows that there's a momentousness to each of our decisions, and that even tiny choices in our interactions with whatever platform or online situation have consequences. So just to do it, to understand that momentousness and our tendency to be malleable, so that if you can monitor your internal state, your bodily state, while doing these things, because there's also, it's not possible just to draw a bright line and say, these things are good, these things are bad. This thing will only tell you truth. This thing will only lie to you. It's actually the guiding line, I think, has to come back to ourselves and our own capabilities. There's a great quote I came across from Solzhenitsyn, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, where he says, "The line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart."
Wow. I love that. That's poetry.
Yeah, and hard won poetry, which is the best kind.
Well,
arguably. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay. I mean, you know, as you're talking about truth and knowing things, and it's what you experience and not necessarily what you're told, how would you approach the following, which is that a lot of people are made to doubt their own input of information and what they see, what they think, and they're told by manipulators that what they see and how they see it is wrong. And so what would help people trust their view of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are in a crisis just as much as we could be in a crisis of truth. We're in a crisis of trust. And it's as if trust has been removed from the system. And there's a famous line that actually inspired the whole crypto movement, which is really just about that, you know, a kind of falling away of trust in financial systems and therefore building one that seems to promise a kind of autonomy. So I think maybe understanding the bigger picture, that this is a global, it's almost like, you know, just as in 2008, there was a crisis of credit that globally affected our world, where just credit got sucked out of the system, as I understand it. Likewise, we're feeling that with trust right now. We're experiencing it. And it's not just that in this country or certain countries or the countries we have relationships with, or it's actually a global phenomenon that if you understand it and maybe depersonalize it, I think grasping after certainty is part of the problem that a lot of us fall into. Like, if this isn't, you know, this thing I used to find to be reliable is no longer such, so what can I find to take its place? Or just to be, in the words of Pema Chodron, she has a book called Comfortable with Uncertainty. It's kind of, unfortunately or fortunately, a lesson, you know, to find skills that allow you to find some ground in the groundlessness of no change, which we're in a period of rapid change. So having a wider perspective, seeing that it's not simply personal or vituperative against oneself, but also finding some comfort, finding activities that do ground you, because I think ungrounding is one of my big findings. Some of it sounds kind of like not a great headline. Professor discovers you should be kind and that ungrounding is bad for you. But I mean, I really think these are profoundly true. And you know, to find the things that can ground you and make you serve as a countervailing force to this kind of larger process that we're experiencing.
And so just as we're finishing up, I'm wondering also about grounding. So when you talk about grounding or ungrounding, what is your vision of that? What does that mean?
So the way I thought of it is, you know, there's a lot of literature on what brainwashing and thought reform is, and Lifton has his famous 8 qualities, or, you know, that among them milieu control that must be there for it to take place. But what I found was that before these 8 things, and before even milieu control, there is a period of rapid disorientation or successive shocks to the point of disorientation that are sustained in one system, and that those precede and almost prepare the way for the transformation or this effect. So that's how I define ungrounding. And I can, you know, you can locate it in the experiences of people where they're just find themselves. Often the phrase, I found myself in a place I'd never anticipated, you know, a 17-year-old sent to Korea to fight who's never left Dutchess County, New York, or doesn't even know it's a war. They think they're in a police action. They're going to be like working with ambulances, and they're suddenly in a ditch being captured by Chinese soldiers. And, you know, this, it's highly disorienting to say the least. And then this lasts for three years. Who of us can say how we would react? But that's kind of where I got this sense of ungrounding. You can also hear it in testimonials from people who it was just like we were describing, you're sort of brought into a group, an online cult or QAnon or something like that, and can find yourself ungrounded. So that's how I define it.
A lot of people ask me now about how to handle all that's being thrown at them, all the changes, all of the upheaval, all of the new edicts and proclamations and laws, and that it's more than our system can tolerate. And so a lot of people just shut down. And then they feel bad about shutting down because they want to be on top of what's happening and they want to be able to participate if they can, but they don't even quite know the way in. So, or in a healthy way to how to sustain all that. And so what would your advice be now for people who are just overwhelmed, who are trying to stay grounded, but also don't want to just dissociate to make it through the day?
Okay. This is a great question. I think it's a question. People have been stopping me on the running trail around Fresh Pond every day. You like asking that question and some version of it. And I think it's like such an important question because one feels that if you go out and take a walk, maybe you're neglecting your duty to stay on top of what's happening. But one way I think of it myself is I go back to one of my favorite songs, which is by Bob Dylan, who wrote this great song in 1962 called "It's a Hard Grain's Gonna Fall," which I think is, I mean, it's a profound song. And at the time people said, this must be in response to the nuclear threat, or it's a, you know, it's about environmental degradation. And they interpret it as a war cry against certain evils or ills or political programs. And in an interview with Studs Terkel at the time, Bob Dylan said in his inimitable way, he said, it's not about nuclear. It's not an anti-nuke song. It's just about the kind of thing that's just going to happen. And in that way, I think he said, this is a prophetic song. He's saying, and if you listen to it, you'll see, it's just about, it is kind of about massive apocalyptic change that the world was going through then. And he's not saying, I don't think he's saying it's just going to happen, therefore go bury your head in the sand or go do your, you know, merely escape, merely bypass this. He's saying, I mean, he wrote the song, but it's a question of finding the place where you can be useful, where you have a particular thing and not feeling that each of us has to simply doom scroll all night because we think that somehow that's helping. In other words, there's ample, you know, finding a circle of care, a place where one's efforts can be as useful as possible, but also maintaining your groundedness. That's my thought about it.
I'm going to try to put a link to the song in the show notes because, yes, there's a reason he's won all these awards for his words. So where can people find you, find your book, and what you've been working on?
I have a website, RebeccaLamov.com, but I also have my university website, which has information. And I have an academia.edu website too, under my name, where you can get free copies of my articles too.
Great. Okay. And so we'll provide a link to that too. Okay. That's wonderful. Rebecca, my goodness. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. This was really wonderful and so rich and so important. And I really, really appreciate this conversation.
So do I. I really appreciate it. Same back to you. I hope we get a chance to meet in person.
Oh, that would be great. That'd be great. I'll be in touch next time I'm out your way.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Good. Thank you.
Thanks, Rachel.
One more thing before you go. It is so good to talk to someone who is bright, who's thoughtful, who knows a lot about how people think and what people think. And it is really important for people to be out there who are scholars, who are professors, who are really researching data and technology and history and behavior. And the history of the human is a fascinating thing to me. Understanding the human condition, understanding how people relate to each other, understanding what people are looking for. I hear so often from people that what they were looking for were two main things: community and certainty. And within that, cults jump right in and they say, we've got you covered. You will have an instant community. You will also have certainty. We will promise you that. We will promise to give you all the answers. We will promise to give you the truth. And I know Rebecca and I talked a lot about the truth and what it means to be given the truth. I loved when she said that the truth is what you experience yourself and not what you're told. And we know that even in smaller ways. If we're told to visit a certain place, travel to a certain place, meet a certain person, and none of those places or people are in line with what we were told about them, they don't meet the expectation or at least the definition given by somebody else, because people's ideas about all of that are going to be subjective. So how do we focus on objective truths? Knowing also that the scientific model is that there's new information all the time, and you want to make sure to make space for that and integrate that into your new truth, the new definition of what something is. Cult leaders very often are stuck in what they were told to tell you by the people who taught them, who raised them up to be the cult leader, or they're stuck in what they wrote down, if they started the cult, as the teachings, as the belief systems, and they can't really change them all that much, even though some cult leaders do, and then they'll always have an excuse for why they're doing that. But maturity, I think, and real emotional development is made very clear in a lot of people by how flexible they are. And I have found cult leaders, malignant narcissists, to be a very inflexible group of people. Once they've said it out loud, they feel like they need to stick with it. This is one of the principles, actually, that Robert J. Lifton talks about. You know, once you have this idea that, you know, you now have recruited people and you've given the party line, you then feel a sense of responsibility that you need to adhere to that. You need to back your words up. And so it is hard for people to have the access to the kind of confidence it takes to make those adjustments. I remember years ago watching Stephen Colbert's show, and he used to talk about truthiness. It wasn't really truth, it was truthiness. And he would quote a lot of people in government as having their own version of truthiness. I remember also going, and I've talked about this here and there on the podcast, going to the Kabbalah Learning Center for one of their free introductory meetings and being told that everything that you've been told is true is a lie, and everything that you told was a lie is the truth. Everything that you can see, smell, taste, touch through all of your senses is a lie. And only the invisible kind of notions and powers and energies floating around you in the ether are the real truth, but you don't have access to them. Only we do, and we can show you how to find them. So everything invisible, that's the thing you need to pay attention to. But of course, if it's invisible, you can't see it, but we're going to help you. It's like everything that you need to know was written in invisible ink, and we have the pen to draw over it to make the writing come to life. Talk about dependency inducing. Talk about saying, you need us. You need us for all the truth. It is disorienting. It's wrong. It is so alarmingly handicapping also when you hear stories like this. I am very happy to have had the chance to talk to Rebecca about this idea that she talks about how we're in a crisis of trust. And I couldn't agree with her more. Who's telling the truth? Who's not? And how do we know? And also, if people aren't telling us the truth, why? And why do they feel okay about that? That's the piece that I go to also. what makes that okay in their mind? It's fascinating. It's disturbing. And I hope to be able to talk to her again. Take good care. Talk to you all next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
First, there was Tuesday. Then, there was Taco Tuesday. Now at Wendy's, there's Takis Tuesday. Get a new Takis Fuego meal, a.k.a. Takis Fuego chicken sandwich, Fuego fries inspired by Takis, a bag of Takis Fuego chips, a small drink, and also a small Frosty classic. Yes, you can get that any day, but on Takis Tuesday, the Frosty is free. Make every Tuesday a Takis Tuesday. Gotta be Wendy's.
Limited time only. Participating U.S. Wendy's includes 1 ounce Takis Fuego chips while supplies last. Takis and Fuego trademarks are used under license.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.